6322. On February 2nd, 2018, a hearing was held here at the Commission Room in Bismarck. And then on March 29th, 2018, the Commission issued a notice of opportunity for consolidated hearing, which provided until May 4th, 2018 for receiving written comments and hearing requests regarding the additional issues covered by the settlement agreement, but they weren't previously noticed, and that was whether or not NSP's proposal to terminate its power purchase agreement with Laurentian, if that was prudent, and then was it reasonable and appropriate to waive the provisions of the automatic adjustment clause. And that's rule in North Dakota Century Code 69-09-02-39. On May 4th, 2018, written comments were received from both Red Willow Management on behalf of Benson Biomass Supplies and Haulers, Red Willow, and also on May 4th, 2018, written comments and a request for hearing were received from the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers of Minnesota. Related to that, the comments and requests for hearing filed by both of them, both Red Willow and the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers of Minnesota, that was deemed not to be relevant to the North Dakota Commission, that they were proceedings related to Minnesota and impacts related to Minnesota, and that they did not represent North Dakota ratepayer interests as a result of that. So those were deemed not relevant, for lack of a better description, to this commission. So, subject to the terms and agreements, current terms and conditions of the order, staff recommended, and the order is that deferred accounting treatment be granted for Pine Bend, for Laurentian, and for Benson. And also, just a note on the Hennepin Energy Recovery Center, or known as HERC, that was withdrawn. Requested to be withdrawn by NSP. So that was taken out, then Laurentian came into the picture. So really, what does this mean at the end of the day is really the big question on this. And these are a series of biomass agreements that were put in place to satisfy both PURPA obligations and also Minnesota Renewable requirements as well. They're also tied, and there are a lot of moving parts on these, they're also tied to the biomass agreements on the Minnesota side. We're tied to being able to store nuclear waste on site at the Prairie Island nuclear facility. And that was also in part due to the fact that the Yucca Mountain nuclear depository wasn't moving forward. They could not move nuclear waste to that facility. There wasn't another place, so they had to put storage casks on site, and that tied into all of this as well. So I think when I was looking and going through the information, and as we've gone through this, because it's been active for a while, I think it's an example of too many influencers, if you will, that are driving the market more than the market itself, just operating openly and deciding what the least cost resource might be. That's really apparent here, because these biomass production facilities have not been deemed economical and not beneficial to ratepayers. So as a result, there is a savings to North Dakota ratepayers. And when you look at the numbers spread out for Benson and Pine Bend over 11 years, it equates to approximately $8.24 per year, or a 69-cent per month savings. And that would come through the fuel clause adjustment. And then for Laurentian, That one's a little bit different, but that's a total of $4.8 million over 9 years, or $2.50 per year per customer, 21 cents a month. So combined, you're still looking at 90 cents per month on a per customer basis for an average residential customer. That will be the savings to them. So it is material in terms of the total dollar amount for these being discontinued. Sometimes, you know, when you look back and you think, well, how can it be less to actually buy a facility and then just shut it down? I think underscores that they weren't terribly efficient to begin with. So, obviously, just so many more additional moving parts, but I think I summed it up as concisely, or maybe not as concisely as I could have, because I'd probably have to talk for another 30 minutes, and nobody wants that at this point. So that would be it for me on this particular motion.
We have a motion, a second. Is there any further discussion?
I wanted another 30 minutes, but I don't want to argue. But Commissioner Fedorchak?
Well, I think you did a great job summarizing it. It's pretty complicated, complicated project. It was complicated from the beginning. And I think that the commission, although none of us were here when this agreement was initially put into place, I do think it was a intentional move by the commission at the time to extend the life of the nuclear facilities. And so it was a trade-off, recognizing that Minnesota environmental groups were actively trying to shut down those nuclear facilities. This allowed a compromise to be struck to keep them open in exchange for these really costly and, at the time, experimental biomass projects. And I give the company credit for looking at the effectiveness of those facilities and going back to the legislature and working through what needed to be done, to the Minnesota legislature, working through what needed to be done to get out of those contracts and save ratepayers the dollars that were being spent on them. I don't think the technology turned out to be as effective as anybody had hoped. So this is a great savings for North Dakota customers. What's the total amount, Brian?
The total amount is $24.1 million, but the 19.3 is spread out over 11, and then that's for Pine Bend and Benson. Laurentian's $4.8 million over 9 years. So
yeah, so $24 million savings to North Dakota customers. That's going to benefit our ratepayers and allow us to put this kind of a project behind us and move on to what we like to do, which is basing our generation choices on cost and need.
Is there any further discussion?
Yes. You know, when I first tackled the first big binder of information on this case, I was firmly believing that I was not going to vote for this thing, because why should North Dakota consumers spend almost the next decade paying additional money for something that's not used and useful? It's not even going to be in existence anymore. That just goes against my grain. But as I got into that information, I realized that the cost to consumers for using these projects was so high. I was shocked. But it's an example of what happens when legislators or regulators abandon the concept of long-term low cost and instead ensnare utility companies into social engineering or economic development schemes. What happens is the politicians get huge headlines and the consumers get huge electric bills. So I'm sad that the cost to consumers for this life vest is as high as it is, but I am pleased to help the NSP customers flee these sinking ships.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
I move the commission adopt the order in Montana Dakota Utilities Company, Great Plains, excuse me, holding company structure, application case number PU-18-75.
Second.
On January 31st, 2018, Montana Dakota Utilities Company and Great Plains Natural Gas filed an application to implement a plan of reorganization through which Montana Dakota and Great Plains, currently operating divisions of MDU Resources Group Incorporated, will become a wholly owned subsidiary of a newly formed holding company. The operations of Great Plains will be conducted as a division of Montana Dakota. The applicants contend that the new holding company will reduce financial and legal risk because of increasing the degree of financial separation between MDU Resources and other regulated and non-regulated affiliates, not alter the Commission's ability to effectively regulate the utility operations, continue to provide safe and reliable electric and natural gas service to customers, create a more transparent business model structure, offer flexibility for the public utility business to separately access capital markets, not result in employment changes, and not result in changes to currently effective electric and natural gas service rates. On April 11, 2018, the Commission issued a Notice of Opportunity for Hearing, which provided until May 31, 2018, for receiving written comments and hearing requests. On June 13, 2018, an informal hearing was held to discuss the application. The Commission finds that the holding company corporate structure application is in the public interest. And again, this does create legal separation from the parent company. It does result in a more secure utility operation because of that separation. They can also separately access capital markets, as earlier stated, and protect ratepayers from non-regulated financial risks, as well as making the allocation of corporate-wide resources and costs easier to track and review. So when we're going through rate cases in particular, or review of their financials, that we can take a not that we could not get to the numbers in the past, but this will certainly help clean things up. And I think from a capital market standpoint, that's one thing that continues to come into play, and it's so important that our investor owns, who we regulate from a rate standpoint, but any utility company has access to capital so they can continue to make necessary improvements and remain financially stable. That stability is important from a ratepayer perspective. And sometimes I think that's the hardest part to really get your arms around in terms of how do you create that balance between making sure that companies want to invest in the utilities that we regulate, and MDU is a North Dakota based company, so that's important that they're attracting outside capital as well to continue to effectively operate. And I'm going through this personally and looking at it, and then working with staff, and I should have said this on the other case as well. Commissioner Fedorchuk alluded to how complicated the previous case was, and it really was. And I think nobody knows better than staff, who spent a lot of time on that, as well as this and the next one that I'll be talking about as well. But I certainly think this is a good move. I like the transparency part of it in particular. I think for me that's one of the biggest selling points, is that it creates a more transparent business structure, and that's just easier for ratepayers to be able to inspect what's going on, as well as the Commission.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I just want to make one point of clarification, because this is an issue that often comes up in the public input sessions with companies like MDU that have a larger parent company, and there's confusion among ratepayers about what, when the company is making a bunch of profits, then why does the utility need to raise its rates? Why can't they? And so there's confusion there, and we've always assured, and the company has too, that the books are separate, and that they're, totally different, And I think this particular move might be confusing to people who have heard us say that they're separate. And now this further clarifies that. But I want to make the point that they always have kept the books separate. There's been separate accounting. There hasn't been a crossover of expenses and profits, et cetera. This is just more of a formality to legally separate them and create that, you know, definite fence between the two and just further clarify it and allow them to separately access capital markets and have just complete transparency between the two entities. So I think this is a good move. It's something that most of the utilities that have holding company have done, and MDU just stated that it's something that they've been thinking about doing for a number of years and just finally decided now was the time to take care of it. So I'm pleased that they've done that. I think it's a step in the right direction, and I'm happy to support it.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, and my final item, and if anyone needs coffee, you're going to have time before we really get into the meat and potatoes of this. so hang on.
It's gonna, okay.
I move the commission approve each respective revised decommissioning plan and cost estimate, all filed December 22nd, 2017, in case number PU-10-101, FPL Energy, Oliver Wind 1, LLC, 50.6 megawatt, Oliver Wind Energy Center, Center, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and costs. Case number PU-10-102, FPL Energy, Burley County Wind, LLC, 49.5 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Wilton, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-103, Ashtabula Wind, LLC, 148.5 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Valley City, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-104, Ashtabula Wind 2, LLC, 120 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Valley City, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-105, Langdon Wind, LLC, 159 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Langdon, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-106, FPL Energy Wind, FPL Energy North Dakota Wind 2, LLC, 21 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Edgeley, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-107, FPL Energy, North Dakota Wind, LLC, 40.5 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Edgeley, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-108, Wilton Wind 2, LLC, 49.5 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Wilton, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-10-110, FPL Energy, Oliver Wind 2, LLC, 48.0 megawatt Wind Energy Center, Center, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-11-171, Ashtabula Wind 3, LLC, Wind Energy Center, Barnes County, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-11-172, Baldwin Wind, LLC, Wind Energy Center, Burley County, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-16-641, Brady Wind, LLC, Wind Energy Center, Stark County, decommissioning plan and cost. Case number PU-16-642, Brady Wind 2, LLC, Wind Energy Center, Hettinger and Stark Counties, decommissioning plan and cost. And case number PU-16-690, Oliver Wind 3, LLC, Wind Energy Conversion Facility, Morton and Oliver, decommissioning plan and cost. So one of the reasons...
Do we need a second?
We need a second.
Oh. Second. I kind of lost track of whether
we that's right. That or not.
And I will add before you explain further the motion that this is a day when, even though I'm kind of a stickler about parliamentary procedure, this is a day that I'm glad that the commission has not historically followed the old parliamentary procedure mechanism of the chair restating the motion before a vote is taken. Commissioner Crashes.
All right. One of the reasons, well, a couple of reasons. One, this originally was on consent, although actually now I'm thinking that would have given me a chance to catch my breath. This was originally on consent, the 14, and it probably would have moved through without a lot of fanfare and discussion. But this is the first grouping that relates to the new decommissioning rules that were put in place on July 1st. So I really wanted to give the other two, after my comments, the other two commissioners the opportunity if they want to offer their comments. But there's a lot of work that took place behind developing those rules. There were rules in place prior, but they lacked consistency because they weren't nearly as defined. This the new rule package certainly strengthens what is out there in terms of the requirements for decommissioning a wind energy production facility once it has reached the end of its useful life. So we're talking about 14 plans here. Seven have submitted their decommissioning plan and cost estimates along with financial assurances because they are more than 10 years old. The other seven out of the 14 will have to provide that financial assurance criteria or proof, if you will, as they reach their 10-year, as they reach the 10-year period of being, is it in production or from the site in production? So again, you know, there are some changes in the rules. I think, you know, we know about the fact that concrete removal was at a depth of 3 feet. It went to 4 feet. So that was new. Decommissioning plans that had been turned in prior, many of them included salvage value for the scrap metal, but that is an unpredictable market. So if that decommissioning plan had come in during a period of high scrap prices, high salvage value, and then you entered into a period when they're actually decommissioned where that isn't the case, not necessarily, it doesn't, didn't instill a lot of confidence that they might have enough money at the time. So salvage value is not a consideration. They cannot include that in terms of the decommissioning cost. They can't subtract what they think they might get on the salvage value. So generally speaking, looking at these cases are all very similar. It's right around $125,000 per turbine to decommission a wind energy facility. So you're going to have some variances because if it's a small facility with fewer turbines, you still have to get the equipment there. You still have to go through the process. But as a rule, you're looking at right around $125,000. And also, that bid has to be to decommission. The estimate, the cost estimate, as a part of the changes, has to now be done by a North Dakota registered professional, registered engineer. So someone actually residing in the state of North Dakota that is closest to the market conditions, or closer to the market conditions. I think that's a fair point. But a lot of work went into this, and at the end of the day, you want to make sure that during the siting process, we talk about requirements in terms of topsoil segregation from subsoil removal and road construction in particular, but also at the pedestal site or the turbine site. So there's a lot of talk about that. That really fits into when the siting occurs, how they have to go about that. But then that also comes into play in terms of road removal at the end of the lifespan of that facility, unless a producer or I'm thinking typically ag producers own the land, but the landowner, we'll call it that, decides they want the access roads to be left in place. If they want those roads left in place that connect the turbines because it may be, provide greater access in their pasture, that's up to them. That's up to the landowner ultimately if they want them to be left in. But if not, unless otherwise stated, they have to be removed. This is really a forward-looking approach. One, having the financial assurance in place is an excellent way to strengthen the rule, knowing that money will be available when that time comes. What we don't know is how long these facilities will actually be in operation. Many will be repowered with new technology moving forward. We're seeing that already. Particularly in other parts of the country, a lot of repowering of what were lower capacity turbines are being replaced with higher capacity, higher generating power or turbines that generate more energy than in the past. So I don't know what the crystal ball holds in terms of when these facilities may actually come out of production. I think it's safe to say that it would certainly be decades, I think, for a number of them before decommissioning would actually occur. But rather than speculate on when that on the timing, better have the financial assurances in place now. And this is something very similar in terms of what other energy industry sectors have to go through. So it's I think different in some respects, because the rule package is modified, it's a different type of facility. But in principle, this is consistent, and we just want to make sure at the end of the day that we're taking good care of the environment when any type of energy production facility goes offline and is no longer in use.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I'm pretty excited about this motion because, you know, the timing of my life has pretty much tracked the history of coal reclamation in North Dakota, and that's been particularly important to me because a big part of the impact of coal mining and the ultimate reclamation is in my home area up there. So I've lived and watched it my whole life, and I've always been very grateful that previous generations looked to the future, made that commitment to future generations to require that reclamation, because it's not a sound financial move. It comes at a great cost. It's not the efficient way to extract that coal and create energy, but it was the right way of doing it. And when I pursued this position, one of my goals was to take that knowledge that we've gained in decades of running a coal reclamation program so well and use it to create an equally effective wind farm reclamation program. Now, the coal mine reclamation program continues to evolve. Even after all these decades, we have a tweak to the rules, I think, coming up in the very near future again. So it continues to evolve, and so certainly the rules packages that we've put into place are going to have multiple revisions over multiple years before this is all done. But we've got a great start here. Just one little thing that I would state, I think, differently than you did, Commissioner Crassus, as far as the road removal. It is presumed in the rules that they will be removed. If the landowner wants them, that will be taken into consideration by the commission. But my understanding is the commission will ultimately make that choice. And I have felt strongly about that because I don't want the incentive to be there to, for example, say, well, it's going to cost $10,000 to reclaim this area of road. We'll give you $5,000 just to leave it and let it slowly evolve into an erosion problem or something. So there needs to be a rationale behind it, I hope, when that time comes, and that those decisions will be made. If a road is, to use the example from BK1, used and useful, then it should be left. But if it's just the cheap way out, then it should be reclaimed. I do think there's going to be more revisions to this program, like I said, but we've got a great start here. The reporting package, where there'll be annual reports and where there is a minimum level of output, that if that is not met, the wind farm is deemed to be no longer useful. Now the company can rebut that with a case of, you know, they were repowering that year, so they didn't produce anything or something like that. And so it's a rebuttable presumption, but it is there. And one of the big points, and that was another thing that I feel so good about our rules package, you can't have these wind farms out there become abandoned, but maybe just be switched on for an hour or two a year just to say that they're still used. And so there are minimums involved here. I think we've got a great start to this rule package, and I really appreciate NextEra has a lot of projects in the state. They moved forward. They didn't drag their feet here and, you know, ask for extensions and things like that. I know it was a big process to put these decommissioning plans together, and I appreciate that they got them done and we're continuing to move forward. And I think just as I and I believe a lot of others sit and appreciate those previous generations for their commitment to the future, I think we're going to get 40 or 50 or 60 years from now, and there's going to be people around the state who are going to be grateful that we thought about future generations as well and made sure that these things are cleaned up when they are no longer useful.
Is there any further discussion?
I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, kudos to Randy. He really spearheaded this effort and got staff on board working through it with Jack. You guys did a really good job. It's very thorough, and it's well thought out. You tried to anticipate what things might come up, what the pitfalls might be, what sort of issues might occur in the future that we can't really anticipate right now. So I think you did a really good job with that. And there was a lot of great exchange with industry as well, back and forth for a number of months on the plan and how to make it effective and workable. So really great leadership you provided on that. So thank you for that. And then just on the plan as a whole, the technology has created so many new opportunities in the electric industry and a lot of excitement in the electric industry. And it's also created a lot of uncertainty in the electric industry. And the one thing, really, the only thing that we can be certain about is that future generation will be different than it is today. And someday, these wind turbines will come down. And this work today really does ensure three things. First of all, that when that day comes, the company knows what's expected of taking them down and how to reclaim the land so that it's productive and beautiful and the way it was before the wind towers were erected. Secondly, they'll know, they'll be aware of and prepared for what the cost will be, because the plan requires them to get engineering estimates on the cost of taking down the turbines and reclaiming the facility. And then finally, they'll have money to do that because of the financial assurances that will be in place. So it's really an important three-part program, and I think it really does pave the way for proper long-term development of the wind industry and reclamation of the industry when something else new and exciting comes along and really replaces that.
Is there any further discussion?
I just want to clarify, just so there isn't any confusion on the road issue, because there might be. Each plan does include, in terms of the estimate, the $125,000. Each one does include that the aggregate base roads, the tower access roads, will be removed. They will be taken out. And the $125,000, again, is more of a ballpark figure in a wind farm that may only have, I'm looking at one here that has 22 turbines, that's $135,000, so it will vary a little bit. But that land will be restored to its original topography. The subsoil will be restored to to the original depth. But I think we also have to be very careful and not giving the impression that landowners don't have a say in whether or not they want that road to remain. Because ultimately, this is their land. They own it. These are on private tracts of land. They're not on state land. They're not on federal land. They're on private tracts of land. So then you get into what's our role in terms of easement issues. And that's really between the landowner and the companies for any type of energy facility, whether it's a pipeline, whether it's a wind farm, whether it's a gas plant. Our job is to make sure that we're helping look out for landowner interests, but we also have to make sure that we're not inhibiting their ability to make decisions with their own personal property as well.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That is, concludes my
agenda. Concludes our regularly scheduled meeting, except for this afternoon, we have an informal hearing on multiple NSP cases on I'm not going to read them all off, but it was previously listed as being at 1:30 and it is at 12 o'clock instead. And our next regular scheduled meeting is not on a Wednesday like would normally be the case. It is on Monday, July 9th at 10 o'clock. That, I think, concludes the announcements. So we will stand in recess until 5 minutes to 11. We'll set the time. We'll stand in recess for some questions from the press, and then we'll set the time when we know how many questions there are. So
about 60 or 70.
You stand in recess.
Okay, just quickly on the decommissioning things. Are you talking about bonding when you're talking about financial assurance? More likely, or
bonding, surety bonds. But I think there are other. Jerry, that's a good question in terms of what is the range in terms of types of financial assurances. Some might be able to self-bond, some would.
The rules have requirements in them for self-bonding and as that option to a form of them providing their own financial assurance. So it could be a surety bond or other forms of financial assurance, letter of credit or something.
As long as they can prove that they've got money in the bank or money at the ready if they have to decommission.
Well, I think it's also up to the commission individually whether to accept what they propose as financial assurance.
The rules on a company's qualifications or where we would accept a corporate guarantee or something like that very much mirror the rules for coal mine reclamation.
Secondly, on those cases with the biomass, $24 million is what you said?
$24.1 million between the three, with the three combined. That'd be Benson, Pine Ben, and Laurentian. The time periods that that money is spread out is slightly different. For the first two, it's 11 years. For the Laurentian facility, it's over a 9-year period.
Did I get you correctly that it's about 90 cents a month?
If you combine the two, it would be 90 cents a month for the first 9 years, and then in years 10 and 11, to finish out Benson and Pine Bend, it would then drop to 69 cents a month. But for the first 9 years, it's going to collectively be 90 cents. So it's material savings in terms of, and then there was a trade-off I think Commissioner Fedorchuk stated it accurately that on one hand you would look and say, why are we entering into biomass agreements when they're being driven, especially those on the Minnesota side? But it also provided access to very low-cost nuclear energy as well, electricity being produced at the nuclear facility. So I think you have to look at them as a package deal. I'm sure, I guess I can't speculate what the previous commission did, but I would speculate they looked at it as a package deal.
And on BK2, with the separation of the two companies, could we call it Big Brother and the Holding Company?
Call it what?
Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Well, I don't know that I want to be quoted that way, so.
Janis Joplin would be pleased.
But I did hear we have a chance of rain tonight.
Oh.
How's that? So, no, I you know, another great point was brought up on that, and we've always, as far as I know, that, you know, when you look at a rate case and you dive into the numbers, you're asking the questions about, okay, is this allocation of cost that's coming from the overarching entity appropriate in terms of a percentage or amount to be applied to North Dakota ratepayers? So that due diligence has been done the entire way, as far as I can see. I don't see any examples where it wasn't scrutinized, and some things are denied, some of the requests in any rate case. In fact, a number are often denied, saying, no, you're not going to get recovery for that. So it was always inspected. But I think having that separation, I think it makes it a little bit easier in terms of just providing a more clear picture when approaching capital markets. And I think it helps us to some extent get to the final numbers a little bit faster versus having to start to segregate and separate during the course of a rate case. So I think that's helpful. And hopefully at the end of the day, it is in fact more transparent to the rate payer.
So there would be a fence, but it would be a chain link fence.
Yeah, 40% chance of thunderstorms, I think. No, it's it's not unusual for companies to restructure and in this particular manner. So it's not an unusual move at all, and I think it was a pretty easy decision for me anyway.
I could ask you how often you use the state plane, but I won't.
Okay. We will reconvene at 10 o'clock.